Today, we're observing Juneteenth, the new federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S. It was signed into law by President Biden, who at a ceremony Thursday declined to answer this question from a reporter.
Mr. President, is Election Day next? Is the plan to sign Election Day a national holiday?
Making Election Day a federal holiday may actually come up for debate next week. That's when the Senate is expected to vote on a sweeping bill to expand national voter registration and voting access, which Democrats say is their highest priority. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. We have Margaret Talov, who is managing editor at Axios, and Scott Wong, who is a staff writer at The Hill. Hello to you both.
Hi, Tanya. Hi, Colin. Great to be with you.
Happy Friday. So, Margaret, remind us, why do Democrats say this is their highest priority and what changes do they want to see in elections?
I mean, you need look no further than the 2020 elections to understand how crucial turnout and making it easier for turnout is to people. The pandemic had the sort of counterintuitive effect of forcing many states to quickly move to give people more flexibility in voting. And look what happened. And boy, it was a squeaker. And that answers the other question, why don't Republicans want this? So S1 is the big sweeping overall arching voting rights expansion and reform bill that we've been hearing about for months. That's the For the People Act. It's clear there's not bipartisan support for it. But where this has taken a turn in recent days is that Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who is a Democrat but confounds all Democrats by blocking many of the things that they want to do, had said that he could support a kind of a scaled-back compromise that would still greatly expand and cement national protections for voting, including making Election Day a holiday, including, you know, 2 weeks of minimum early voting. And that is now where we stand. Republicans say no way. And Democrats say you have to do it. There's no excuse not to do it.
Let's get into the Joe Manchin situation in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about and bring in Scott Wong here. Republicans lined up at a press conference yesterday to take aim at this. Here's John Barrasso of Wyoming.
The more people find out about this, the less they like it. It is radical. It's extreme. It is dangerous. It is scary.
In particular, Republicans don't like a provision to set up independent commissions to draw new maps for congressional seats. Scott, why is that one of their biggest criticisms of this bill?
Well, I think that, traditionally there had been state legislatures that had drawn congressional district maps every 10 years or so. And, those debates and those fights get very partisan. And, when Republicans control legislatures, which they control most of them in the country, though that tends to favor Republicans. And so they don't want to see these changes. I mean, one of the proposals that Joe Manchin is proposing in his scaled back plan is to ban partisan gerrymandering and to rely more on computer models to draw these congressional districts, which would be much more fair. You wouldn't see these really strangely shaped congressional districts that we've seen these maps of in recent decades. And so that's just one provision that Manchin's looking at. The other would make, as you mentioned earlier, making Election Day a public holiday. Still others would mandate at least 15 consecutive days of early voting for federal elections. So there's actually a lot for Democrats to like here in the scaled back Manchin plan. I think the big question is, could he bring on a lot of the progressives that are really gung-ho in pushing for the For the People Act that had passed the House earlier?
Well, Scott, that is such an important question. Can Joe Manchin rally support to what he's trying to build as kind of this compromise proposal? And it did get a boost of support yesterday when the very prominent voting rights advocate Stacey Abrams endorsed it on CNN. Here she is.
What Senator Manchin is putting forward are some basic building blocks that we need to ensure that democracy is accessible no matter your geography.
So, Margaret, help handicap us now. There's some of what Manchin is proposing. Stacey Abrams says it's good building blocks. Is that going to be enough to rally the support that it would need to pass?
Yeah, this is where understanding those rules and procedures of the Senate you know, really comes in handy, because unlike the infrastructure debate where you can talk about budget reconciliation and 51 votes and all that kind of stuff, like, this is a voting rights bill. You got to change, you got to either eliminate the filibuster, which Manchin said he's not going to do, or water down the filibuster, which Manchin is certainly not committed to doing, or find a bunch of Republicans to cross party lines and say, yes, it would be the right thing to make it easier for poor people and people of color to vote. Okay. And right now they don't have it. So right now, this is looking very much like a test vote where Democrats can prove that Republicans don't really want voter reforms. And then where do they go? And this is all going to come down to a wire ahead of midterms, where Democrats have the barest of bare majorities in the Senate, needing the vice president and unanimity to break a logjam, and a very razor-thin majority in the House as well. Republicans in the Senate and the House both want to be able to try to take back control of both chambers of Congress. And they think that expanding these voting rights, particularly in red states, and overriding what legislatures in red states want to do, is going to hurt them. And this could make a decade's worth of difference in the balance of power across the United States, in state legislatures, in governor's mansions, as well as in Congress. That's why it's being so heavily fought.
Sure. And Margaret, you drew the comparison a moment ago to the infrastructure debate. And let's go there next, because the Senate Budget Committee Chair Bernie Sanders is now floating a $6 trillion infrastructure plan, which would go even farther than the president's. It includes a plan to lower the eligibility for Medicare to age 60, possibly even immigration reform tucked in there as well. Scott, is a $6 trillion infrastructure plan realistic at this point?
I think realistically, it would have to be scaled back. I think that is sort of the dream for progressives, to a $6 trillion plan. I mentioned it to a couple moderates in the halls of Congress this week, and I got a couple of eye rolls. this goes back to the same dynamic with all of these issues that that we're seeing. Progressives and moderates sort of struggling for power, trying to influence the path forward for the Biden agenda. And we're seeing it, up close and personal with infrastructure. On the one hand, you are seeing this plan being put forth by Bernie Sanders and progressives in the face of Biden walking away from those bipartisan talks with Shelley Moore Capito the other day. But at the same time, you are seeing some more momentum from the centrist. Now we're seeing, I think it was 21 members of Congress, 11 Republicans and 10 Democrats, who are saying, we want to move forward on a smaller scale back bipartisan talks. And so, there really is a power struggle happening between the centrists and the progressives on the Biden agenda.
Yeah, those 11 Republicans have actually signed on to this narrower compromise that totals about $1 trillion. I want to talk with you guys, with a little bit of time, though, that we have left, about President Biden's overseas trip. He has just returned. His main message to foreign leaders is America is back. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and Biden said Biden gave Russian President Vladimir Putin a pass on issues like cyber attacks. Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan actually pushed back against criticisms like that. Let's listen.
I just don't buy the argument which says this was not worth it for the United States. As President Biden himself said, he did what he came to do, and I think America's come out better for it.
That was Sullivan on CNN. Biden came away with the first mention of China in a NATO meeting and a new arms dialogue with Russia. Will what happened this week in Geneva have a lasting effect, Margaret?
I think we don't know precisely what effect it's going to have. Biden himself said he thinks it'll be 6 months to a year until you know. But President Biden and his team didn't really feel like they had any choice but to do this, and to do it in a very measured way that was not aimed at making headlines or getting into a power struggle with Putin, but just to say that Helsinki 2018, or Trump's general handling of Russia, could not be kind of the standing U.S. position vis-a-vis Russia, that Biden is trying to usher in a new era in terms of positioning and rhetoric. And he had to come there and say to Putin and to the American audience, which is always what foreign policy trips are also about, to say out loud, these are my red lines. There's a new sheriff in town. This is how it's going to change. Now that he's back home, I think it's some of the attention is going to move away from Russia and in the immediate days, much more towards Iran. You've got the elections in Iran, a new president, all but secured to be this hardline judicial cleric, and real concerns in the U.S. about a closing window to try to put back together some version of the Iranian nuclear deal. But these longer term discussions with Russia over whether there can be a nuclear agreement, what's going on in the Levant in the Middle East, these are all going to begin to proceed to move forward with cyber very much hanging over all of us.
Margaret Tolov is managing editor at Axios, and Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. As always, thanks to you both.
Thank you.